WrestleSpective Radio is not affiliated with World Wrestling Entertainment, TNA Wrestling, Ring of Honor Wrestling, or any other sports entertainment entity or personality.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
Hello, and welcome to WrestleSpective Radio at FairToFlare.com. I am Jason Mann, and joining me, he is a writer for ProWrestling.net and a good man, Will Pruitt. Will, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Just excited to be on your podcast for the first time, and I don't get to talk about a whole lot of wrestling history, so when I get the opportunity to, it's always a privilege.
Well, I'm definitely glad to have you on. Another first-timer, always great to do that. And what history we are going to talk about today. It is the main event of Fall Brawl 1998, and it is War Games. And this was a different War Games than any other in professional wrestling history because it was three teams, and it was every man for himself. I'm not exactly sure how to internally understand that. That seems like a contradiction, but that was the way this match was built. Three teams, but every man for himself. I remember Roddy Piper doing a promo before this match. And granted, by 1998, Piper was mostly incomprehensible 80-90% of the time, but like I had absolutely no idea what this match was supposed to be about, who I was supposed to cheer for, anything. It was very strange. And even if it had been teams, you would have had two teams of good guys against one team of bad guys, which would have been a weird psychology thing. So I guess better off that there was only, you know, every man for themselves.
Yeah, it definitely would have come off as awkward if it were the Wolfpack and WCW taking on the NWO Black and White. But the whole Wolfpack concept itself was awkward because it was a babyface team splitting off of the heel team to form their own babyface team that is still kind of against the other babyface team.
Right.
It never quite worked the way that I think they wanted it to.
No. The whole Wolfpack thing sold a lot of t-shirts, but it really, I feel like, did a lot of long-term damage to WCW. Keeping the NWO going for that long really devalued WCW because they really didn't have any stars other than Goldberg and Page at this point. Piper kinda, but you know, he was in and out a lot, and then Warrior, you know, had that little thing, but he was never really part of WCW, you know, so to speak, and people would turn on him within weeks anyway. So, but yeah, basically they created that faction and put Sting in it, of course, which kind of undermined 2 years of storytelling with Sting. And it was a weird thing. They definitely, maybe there was a lot, maybe there was some short-term benefits to it, but definitely something that long-term really did some damage to WCW.
Oh yeah. And I remember you mentioned putting Sting in there. I remember I was, I think, 10 or 11 when this event happened. So I was very, very young, and I was so excited to see Sting in the Wolfpack. And then a couple years later, I think I was watching some old tapes, and I went, but Sting hates the NWO. wait a minute. Why did he even tease joining the Black and White? Why did Hulk Hogan want Sting on his team so soon anyways? Nothing about it made any sense, but it just became a foregone conclusion at some point in the middle of 1998 that Sting was going to join part of the NWO, and it would be the red and black or white and black.
Right. So the teams here for representing Team WCW are Diamond Dallas Page, Roddy Piper, and the Warrior, who had debuted about a month before that in one of the most surreal events I've ever seen in professional wrestling, which is saying a lot, basically the war. They hadn't really teased it on television, but there was enough internet buzz, and I think Diamond Dallas Page either did a promo the week before or earlier that show that kind of hinted that he was going to be showing up. So the crowd kind of knew he was coming and spent about like 25 minutes just on a rambling monologue that most of it not making sense, setting up his demonstrating his beef with Hulk Hogan after these 8 years, the last time they had fought. And in the beginning of it, getting like one of the biggest reactions behind him that anyone has ever seen. And by the end of it, almost speaking to silence.
Yeah, it was definitely an awkward return. And I think they lost a lot of viewers during that segment. You know,
yeah.
All of this was up against Raw and everything.
Right.
A lot of viewers had to have flipped over the channel to whatever was happening, probably Steve Austin related.
Sure. Although I believe it did draw like some absurd rating for the time. But by like week three or four, the ratings were for Warrior were nothing different than they were for anybody else. So it didn't really work on that level, at least long term either. But yeah, the whole Warrior Hogan saga was like just really like bizarre. And it occurred to me while watching this match that basically the same problems that the Warrior had were the same problems that the Black Scorpion had like 8 years earlier. If you think about like how the Warrior was presented, like how he used like the silly magic tricks that like no one really believed, like how he was just kind of like this mysterious character, but really like, you know, other than disappearing in smoke, really had no sense of mystery. And I think also like the way that the Black Scorpion speaked, I mean, they used like the voiceover and stuff. He always was like hinting at things, but never said anything really like concrete. It was just very, very like I kind of feel like there's some weird similarities between those two characters, even though Warrior ostensibly was the good guy while Black Scorpion was, you know, this evil, you know, evil, I put quotes around genius.
Yeah, I can definitely see what you're getting at there. And I think one of the fun things about Warrior's mystery was how then it wasn't mystery all of a sudden, like the appearing and disappearing and reappearing at the entryway and oh, now he's just running to the ring.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah, like it, all of it, it was tons of mystery, and then, oh, wait, here's a guy.
Exactly.
Yep. Ultimate Warrior.
There he is.
There he goes.
Yep. The Team Hollywood is Hollywood Hulk Hogan, Bret Hart, and Stevie Ray, you know, of certainly an interesting choice to represent NWO Hollywood. But to be fair, there were not like a whole lot of Team NWO Hollywood did not have like a huge amount of star power in it. In fact, Bret wasn't even in that group. He just happened to be friends with Hogan. He was, you know, buddies with Hogan, but was not officially an NWO member at the time.
Yeah, that whole thing was a little awkward. And then you look at who was actually in NWO Hollywood, and you just have to be thankful that Scott Steiner and Buff Bagwell weren't in this match. I think that's the only way to look at it, and be thankful that Stevie Ray, who I think had recently joined NWO Hollywood, was in it.
Yeah, he was fairly new. Now, I disagree about Scott Steiner, because I think Scott Steiner would have been fabulous in this match, but maybe we have different opinions about Scott Steiner, but I don't know. I mean, I will say that I do think that Stevie Ray had weird chemistry with Hulk Hogan, which I want to get into a little bit later once they hit the point in which they were in the match, that I think he actually benefits this match. But from like a star power perspective, he's way, way, way down on the list of everyone else in this match. There's no question about that.
Yeah, Stevie Ray is the only guy in this match, or, well, Stevie Ray and Piper are the only guys in this match to not win a world title, and Stevie Ray is the only one to not deserve a world title.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Stevie Ray is in this match because somebody needs to lose. So
yeah.
And that man is Stevie Ray.
And someone needed to bring in the slapjack.
That too. Yeah. Did Stevie Ray bring in the slapjack? Because it wasn't used at all until Hogan gets there. I thought Hogan brought it in.
That's true. It might have been Hogan. I don't know. I actually was just watching a Nitro from the year 2000 while waiting to go on the air for this. And Stevie Ray had a slapjack in his fanny pack at the time.
Nice.
So I just tend to associate Stevie Ray and flapjacks together.
Yeah, well, well, he had a slapjack. He had slapjack on his trunks. So yeah. So I mean, he was definitely associated with it.
Yeah.
I thought it sounded like you said flapjacks there, which I feel like
I think I did.
Associate Stevie Ray with flapjacks as well as slapjack. So any jack can be associated with Stevie Ray. That's a new rule we just created now. So
I think it's a good one.
Yes.
Can you let me know? Maybe I'm just horribly wrestling uneducated. What the hell is a slapjack?
It's also known as a blackjack, but you couldn't say blackjack because that was racist. I mean, I don't think it's really racist, but maybe it is. So,
okay.
Yeah. It's like you couldn't say foreign object in WCW. You had to say international object.
Mm-hmm.
But it was kind of like that. The term of blackjack may be racist in origin. I don't really have no idea, but that was what they called it instead.
Okay.
And then representing the Wolfpack, we have Kevin Nash, Sting, and Lex Luger. So we have two, of course, WCW stalwarts, you know, in the team NW Wolfpack. The two guys who basically had been in WCW the longest were represented team Wolfpack. So
yeah.
I like the first thing I love about this match, and there's many things to love and there's many things to hate, and the reason we're doing this podcast, I should say, is because we had a random conversation on Twitter. I don't remember what it was. I may have asked some question about like what the best and worst war games were or whatever. That's the kind of thing I do on Twitter. And you somehow brought up as 98 war games as a match that you enjoyed. And I was like, what? And then we had a little bit of discussion about it. And then we decided then that we had to podcast it sometime later. And now is later.
Mm-hmm.
And, I love how in the beginning, and at first I thought you were kind of ridiculous, and now I've seen the match again and thought about it some, I'm kind of on board with you at least to some degree. The first thing I like about this is that Mike Tenay is relaying stats about past war games and giving a scouting report ahead of time. That's what this match needs. About Sting having the most experience, Hogan and Nash being undefeated, the team WCW, none of them having ever been in war games, like that stuff, that's a wonderful Mike Tenay thing that he did.
Yeah, that was a great way that Mike Tenay enhanced matches when he was in WCW. It was just constantly with facts and stats, and it's not like it was hard for him to look this stuff up. He really probably just had to go, war games. Okay, it's been since the 80s. Let's write this down. Oh, look at that. You know, I'm sure it was pretty easy to compile, and Tenay did a really nice job relaying that information.
Yes, but I love that there's, like, he does it for this match. Like, this match, now he doesn't know, obviously, exactly what's going to happen, the ridiculousness that's going to happen. He may have some idea. I don't know how much, I know WCW was kind of notorious about not cluing their announcers into things. So I don't know if he knows that the Warrior is going to come like in a plume of smoke through the ring and then he's going to disappear and all this ridiculousness that's going to come later. But I like, okay, Mike Tenay still treats this like kind of like a serious sport and he's going to relay this and that's what's going to happen and it's great.
Mm-hmm. And even before Tenay started relaying those facts, we had, of course, the cage coming in and all of that.
Sure.
Which is just a fantastic spectacle as... It was about a 2-minute or 3-minute cage lowering ceremony.
Okay.
Complete with all sorts of lighting effects and pyro shooting in every direction, under, over, and in the cage.
Yes.
It was one of the, I think, one of the silliest looking things WCW ever produced, and therefore, of course, one of the best.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. One thing that I will say that hinders this match quite a bit is there are no cameras inside the cage. Every other war games that I can think of had cameras inside the cage, and you got really good up-close action with that. But for some reason, well, my guess is the reason is because there have to be referees in this match because this match, unlike other war games, can end at any time and is by... in an individual pinning or submitting another person, where the other war games were all submission or surrender, which I never understood the difference between submission and surrender, but regardless, basically you just had to shout out throughout the cage and the referee could be outside and it was fine.
Yeah, I found that a little odd, too, not having the cameras in. And I should say my first exposure to this match, it was the only War Games I had ever seen.
Ah.
This was my first one, which also has to do with why I love this match so much.
Uh-huh.
But so the pure spectacle of it, where people who had seen War Games for years before may not sit there and go, wow, two rings. I was marking out for two rings like you would not believe.
Yeah.
So, but I also think it might have to do with, at the time, I think WCW kind of started copying the WWF a little bit more as far as production goes.
Yeah.
And I think they saw their steel cage matches, not their Hell in a Cell, but their other steel cage matches, and saw that the cameras were outside the ring. And as opposed to having the awkward cameraman hugging the side of the cage trying to get a shot, I think they decided to try it the WWF way and have them actually shoot from the outside.
Yeah, maybe. And also, you know, it definitely could be the smoke effect, you know, with the time when we're obviously teasing to later, but when the ring fills with smoke, you may not want to have an issue of Warrior trying to get in and there being, you know, cameras or camera wires in the way, and, you know, him accidentally tripping or some sort of thing like that. I mean, that could be an issue as well. I don't know. It really does, because there's so many wide shots where it's hard to see exactly what's going on, and I really think that kind of hurts certain segments of this match, particularly post the Warrior and Hogan shenanigans. How long had you been watching wrestling when you say you're about 10 or 11 when this match happens? How long had you been into wrestling, and were you into both WCW and WWE, or had you picked just kind of one or the other? I guess you were into WCW if you were watching this.
It was mostly, really up until 1998, mostly the WWE that I watched at the time. And
okay.
That I had been into for about 2 years, on and off, just watching with my big brother, and then we started watching WCW together as well towards the beginning of 1998. And of course, then we went back and I went back as he had seen them, but I went back and watched some old WCW shows from 97 and 96 and all, never Fall Brawl. But, and of course, since then, I've watched a ton of old WCW shows, the good and the absolutely terrible.
Sure. Obviously, both have their merits.
Yeah, both can be a lot of fun. WCW is always an interesting company to watch.
Yeah, yeah. There are not a lot of boring WCW shows. You know, there's always something going on. That's you know, either fantastic or awful, but you know, inescapable.
Yes.
We have our first two, Diamond Dallas Page and Bret Hart. Now, they're playing like the fancy epic War Game music. They don't play their individual music when they come out, which I think is interesting. And we have Michael Buffer doing the intros for War Games, which it seems like not really a Michael Buffer thing to do. Like, you know, usually Buffer's there and he, you know, just does it at the beginning, but Buffer has to do the intros throughout for all nine men, you know, as they come out.
How much do you think Michael Buffer got paid to do that?
You know, we've had this discussion in previous podcasts. I don't know. It feels like you know, probably high four figures, I would guess. I mean, he can't.
I feel like.
Go ahead.
I feel like Michael Buffer himself asked for high four figures for what he's doing, and for this, he did the long introduction, including the Let's Get Ready to Rumble. Plus, he was introducing things throughout the entire match. I mean,
okay. Right.
They were asking him to talk every 2 minutes. I just feel like on the Buffer scale, that's gonna
be five figures?
It's going to ratchet it up every time.
Okay.
I think it could have been in the low five. I'm just guessing here.
Okay, I mean, I guess it's possible. I never really quite understood. I get Buffer has some appeal, but I don't know. I always kind of thought Buffer was a little corny. I just always thought that, you know, I kind of appreciate Buffer a little bit more now, I guess, but I don't know. I'm trying to look at Buffer's Wikipedia page. Although Wikipedia today, when we were recording, is the day that Wikipedia has gone offline. Luckily, I cached it, so I can look at it. It does not have It doesn't have anything about what his fee would be, and I wasn't necessarily expecting it, but it says as of 2009, Buffer had earned over $400 million for licensing on his Let's Get Ready to Rumble trademark.
Wow.
Which seems, even if it isn't true, just feels like it needs to be true, you know? It's yeah. from an ABC News article, so we'll go ahead and just assume it's probably true. So, all right. So Michael Buffer has made a whole lot of money for, like, not that he doesn't have talent, because he certainly has the ability to do what he does, but he has done almost like as much more. He's almost done more with less than almost any other human being who has ever existed, I would have to say.
Yeah, it's one line. He's a decent ring announcer, but it's, you know, it's one line. He's good at what he does, and he's made a ton of money doing it somehow.
Yeah. So we have that. Bret Hart is the United States champ. In fact, he beat Paige for the title, I believe, sometime in August or July. I remember it was on a Nitro. DDP was injured, had a rib injury, and he had the rib injury for like a year, and I believe it was some sort of his rib was injured, and you know, he was fighting despite that injury, and then Bret Hart beat him anyway, sort of reminiscent of something we just recently saw on Raw with Zack Ryder having a rib injury and, you know, and being defeated by Jack Swagger for the US title. Of all things.
Yeah, it definitely felt like that. And I just feel like, and maybe I'm, you know, mixing years in WCW. This is what happens when you watch things out of sync. I feel like DDP's ribs were injured for like half of 1997 and half of 1998.
Yes. Oh, they definitely were. They were injured, I believe, the entire 1998. Like, I don't think he got that tape off his ribs until early 99. And that was when he turned.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was might have been before the term, but it wasn't that far before the term.
Yeah, and I know with rib injuries, I mean, you do all you can do is just be still or tape up and hope that the tape helps to get rid of some of the pain, but that's a really long time to be injured.
Yeah, that's even like that's even challenging Bob Orton's cast for length of injuries.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now Bret was sort of teasing turning babyface at this point. He had helped Lex Luger on the previous Thunder when he was being attacked. And this would sort of lead to Bret teasing, I believe, Bret and Hogan wrestling on a Nitro, and then Sting becoming involved at some point, and then Bret attacking Sting and revealing that it was all a swerve at the time. Now, Bret Hart was constantly sort of doing things like this in WCW, where he was teasing going one way and then ended up, you know, going the other way, which is even pre-Russo, he was doing that. So I don't really know why they did that a lot with Bret, but that was what was going on with Bret at this point.
Yeah, he wrote about it in his book, how, you know, Bret, who's a guy who took his connection with the fans really seriously and really cared about the fans and almost too much. When you read his book, you realize that. And Bret talked about how he'd go in and they'd say, cool, in the opening segment of Nitro, you're basically going to turn babyface. And then at the end of the night, you're going to turn heel again. And Bret basically was constantly just going, but, you know, it's killing me. I don't like doing this to my fans. And as a side note, that's also a really good way to kill someone's heat. If they come in really over and you keep flipping them around, the fans, they just don't respond anymore because they don't know how to.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's happened with a decent number of guys. I mean, Big Show's had that problem. Mm-hmm. Lex Luger, Kurt Angle, you know, there's a number of guys. I don't feel like that's happened in a while, like the last 5 years, at least in WWE. Now TNA turns guys a lot, but I don't think people pay that much attention. I think it's just so ingrained in people that it's not even like a worry anymore. It's just sort of like, okay, that's just sort of how the show is. But it doesn't seem like that's happened a whole lot in WWE, at least, you know, like I said, last 5 or 6 years that I can recall.
yeah, they've been pretty careful about how they use turns, and I think they even at times could use a shocking swerve turn on occasion and not always the slow burn, everyone realizes it's happening and then it happens and no one really cares turn.
I generally prefer the slow burn anticipating when. I think you can overdo that, but I generally prefer that. I, you know, a good swerve turn once in a while is great, but I think the swerve turns are more of an exception than the rule. But yeah, you know, it has been a while since there was that. I guess Mark Henry kind of was. That was just more randomly out of nowhere. I mean, at the time, Mark Henry wasn't somebody the fans really cared about before his big monster push late this year. But yeah, it's been a while. Now, 1998 WCW had swerve turns all the time, you know. In fact, you know, Giant, Big Show, he had one earlier that year. You know, I mean, they were happening, you know, left and right pretty much. And in WWE, too, that was just kind of what was going on at the time.
Yeah, and when I say, you know, I prefer the swerve turn, I mean, I like my heel and babyface turns a lot of times to have a moment, or not even a lot, just, yeah, at a moment. When you look at how a guy like Randy Orton turned babyface in WWE in 2010, there was no moment. It was just, you know, nope, Randy Orton's a good guy now because, hey, he's up against some heels and we got bored of making him a baby. We got bored of making him a heel. So
yes, right. Yeah, that's an excellent point. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, because, yeah, there needs to be like some moment of motivation, some sort of like thing you can point to. I mean, Orton had a thing where Cena picked him as his partner, like, as, you know, as a mystery partner for, I think it was like the Raw after WrestleMania. But yeah, but that wasn't really like, oh, you know, like, you know, Orton saving Cena from an attack, that's a babyface turn, you know, just being the guy who's there, just kind of like, oh, okay, yeah, he's a good guy now, I guess. I think you're right. I think there has been a lack of like establishing those moments as like, okay, you know, now he's done something virtuous. Now he's a good guy.
Mm-hmm.
Or he's done something nefarious. Now he's a bad guy.
And yeah, and to get back to where we were, Hart was just in the middle of that constantly in WCW.
Yes.
Especially at this time. And, you know, the will he or won't he part of the NWO story and not really being in it, but kind of being in it. All of it was just kind of awkward.
No. Yeah, yes, I agree. I will say that I do think that, like, Brett's in-ring stuff in 98 and 99, like, has been forgotten, and I think there's some really good stuff that he has there, and I think he's right to, you know, to be upset about his time in WCW, and I know he kind of just, you know, like, even in his book, he really just kind of rushes through it for the most part. There isn't a whole lot of detail about certain things, but I think he really had some fantastic matches there, you know, kind of forgotten things, you know, Booker T. He obviously had that great Benoit match, which is kind of, you know, in retrospect, you know, not something you can really enjoy that much. So on and so forth, good matches with Finley and guys like that. So there was certainly, like, the wrestling aspect was still pretty fun, but, you know, the storyline aspect, you know, was just, yeah, not so much.
Yeah, and, you know, he had some good stuff with Flair towards the beginning of the year, and of course, we got, a month from this, we got the first ever Bret Hart and Sting match, and that was, I remember really enjoying that match, even though it wasn't quite what I think a lot of people wanted it to be.
Yeah, it was a little flat for me. I mean, they had a couple of others that were okay, but yeah, it was definitely, they had a really good Raw and Nitro, I remember. Like a good just kind of backstage, just, I think it was a setup Halloween Havoc. That was a pretty fun thing. But yeah, I would say that, you know, that feud never really kind of had the momentum behind it that it could have, you know. But, you know, WCW was screwing things up left and right kind of at this point, unfortunately. One thing that they mention, is, during the commentary is that they're going to have a Goldberg Sting match the next night on Nitro, which, like, might have been the best Nitro ever, because it had that match, which was really fun. It had Ric Flair's epic return to WCW and reuniting the Four Horsemen, which is one of my favorite things ever. And it also had a really good Kidman-Juventud Guerrera match, where Kidman won the Cruiserweight title and kind of culminated his breaking free from the Fox storyline and led to his, you know, pretty big, decently big run in WCW.
Yeah, that was a really big show, and it was a really exciting show as well.
Which came after a pay-per-view, which was kind of regarded as one of the worst in history at the time, although I think looking back on it, that's pretty ridiculous because, you know, it's really not all that bad. But definitely, it's funny how one night you can have a show that's so flat and not so good, and the next night you can have one that's so wonderful.
Yeah, it's almost like they saved a lot of the good.
Yes, which of course you kind of want the good to be a pay-per-view as well. You know, the show that you pay for, you kind of want the good. You want the TV show to be good too, but you know, you want to reward those fans who pay a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. As far as the Brett DDP sequence lasts about 5 minutes. Not really anything too notable. Brett works the arm for a while, then DDP tries to go for a quick pin. Brett slaps him, and then DDP slaps him back, and they slug down for a while. Paige tries a diamond cutter, but Brett ends up dropping his face on the turnbuckle. I love that Bobby Heenan, as the announcer, talking about the nine guys who are in there. By the way, I did not mention our announcers, in addition to Mike Tenay, are Tony Schiavone and Bobby Heenan. Bobby Heenan calls them, these are the nine greatest men in our sport.
Yeah, I noticed that too, and I just kind of, when I heard that, I just kind of looked at where I had written down Stevie Ray, and I'm like, close. You might have gotten close.
Yes, yeah. Well, you know, Bobby wasn't, maybe Bobby was just being really, really ironic there. Just really, really, was really dry about it, though, you know? So we have, also, this wasn't Bobby's best night of announcing, because he keeps insisting how Brett and DDP have no idea how much time is left, and that a manager is really useful in that situation because he can tell you, but yet there are time calls every minute of leading in the first 5 minutes. So, and I guess it would be Buffer doing the time calls. Another thing I'm sure he would charge extra for.
I think he would. Are you sure? I was going to say, Bobby, that was funny, talking about how an announcer could, or a manager could tell you, but you wouldn't hear the time calls. Because right. They went into a long thing about how you don't hear anything. You don't hear Goldberg or Weasel. You just hear the man that you're in the ring with.
Oh, okay. So I got that. I didn't realize that was in response to not hearing the time calls. Okay, that's funny. Mm-hmm. Yes, you can't hear the guy with the microphone over the PA, but you can hear the manager, you know, just yelling with his regular voice.
Yeah,
that's... or in Jimmy Hart's case, a megaphone.
Why didn't every manager have a megaphone?
That's a good question. Because it's not only useful for, of course, giving instructions, but it's also useful as a weapon.
Yeah, it's very useful as a weapon. You can get a lot done with a megaphone.
Maybe Jimmy Hart had some sort of like exclusive contract that banned anyone else from using a megaphone.
That would be really interesting to look into. I mean, that's as big as Hogan's creative control, if it is.
Right, right. Well, no, I don't mean like Jimmy Hart the performer. I mean Jimmy Hart the manager had some sort of clause where, you know, no one else was allowed to have a megaphone. Maybe he had that power. You know, he was that important to WWF and WCW during his time. Although WCW, he didn't really keep the megaphone forever. By 98, I don't think he had it anymore.
Nope. Is that an addendum to the manager's license? Like, maybe just in every state, he's registered with the megaphone and the states only allow one megaphoned manager.
These are questions I do not. I wish I knew the answer to, because that would really be fascinating.
Yeah, I think they're important questions to ask when going through this match.
Yes,
that Jimmy Hart is in no way involved in.
Exactly. Well, you know, he managed Hogan. He managed Bret Hart. I guess those are the only two that he managed. He did not manage anyone else. I don't think he ever managed Harlem Heat. So, but you know. Two of these men were he was important in their careers. So,
that's true.
So the first 5 minutes are you basically Brett and DDP doing their thing. Stevie Ray comes in. He is on Brett's side. He helps Brett. Then beats down Paige for a while. Then Brett gets involved and DDP clotheslines them both down. Stevie Ray chokes Paige for a while. Announcers keep being surprised that he's not going for a cover, but then they speculate that, of course, Hogan doesn't want him to go for a cover because Hogan wants to win the match and earn the title shot himself. Those 2 minutes go by pretty fast. We have Sting come out next. Stevie Ray catches him at the door, but Sting dispatches him easily. He's able to get his coat off and does a nice little thing where he leaps from one ring to the another, sort of hitting Stevie Ray with a splash or a clothesline, kind of hard to tell. And then meanwhile, we see DDP get a low blow on Brett.
Yeah, I thought that splash clothesline was kind of an awkward moment. They tried to cover it. It was almost like he was trying to do Undertaker's standard WrestleMania dive that he does now. And it came off as a almost clothesline, almost botch, and the announcers sold it as a Stinger splash, of course.
Oh, okay. It was hard to tell. I mean, that was one advantage of the camera not really being that close, is you didn't get an awkward moment. Like, Sting did that a few times in War Games and Battle Bowls. I recall him doing that a few times, doing kind of a similar thing. So, of course, Sting in 98 wasn't exactly as spry as Sting in 92. So, you know, he may not been able to pull that off quite as easily. So we have Stevie gets sort of stuck between the ropes and the cage. Sting repeatedly splashes him. Meanwhile, Brett pile drives Paige. And we have Piper in next and going after everyone, including his partner, Paige, because every man for himself. And pokes Brett in the eye, bites Stevie Ray in the face, does a double noggin knocker on Paige and Brett. DDP and Piper have a brief standoff. Piper gets him in the eyes and punches him down. Then Brett sends Paige over into the other ring. We have Stevie Ray get stuck in between the rings for a little while. Piper and Sting have a little sequence and go at it. And Sting gives Piper a little bit of his own medicine by biting him. And this makes me kind of wish we had seen a Piper-Sting match. I'm sort of fascinated in what that would have been like.
I was thinking the same thing. And I got a little bit disappointed when I thought, well, you know, Sting was kind of gone soon after this. And Piper, I don't remember being super involved with WCW after this, so it was just kind of, oh, Sting and Piper. That could have been fun and, you know, had a little bit of history behind it, too.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they could have done it in 99 because Piper turned heel in 99 and was Flair's buddy when Flair was president of WCW. And then Sting kind of came along and beat, I think he won the presidency from Flair at some point, so it feels like they could have done it in that. But I mean, if they did, I have no recollection of it. But that would have been a fun, you know, that could have been a fun story to tell at some point. Even in 97, when Piper was kind of the guy who was fighting for WCW and Sting was the guy in the rafters, you could have had Piper, like after that, Piper kind of have some post Sting win the title jealousy, is being like, hey, I was the guy who was here the whole time and you swoop in from the rafters and win the title and, you know, I should have been that guy or whatever, you know? There could have been a good story there.
Yeah, there definitely could have been. And it's, you know, one of those things where you look at just this WCW roster at the time and you think of all of the possibilities that they had for great feuds.
Oh, gosh, yeah, yeah.
And how, you know, and of course, looking back with history, in perspective, it's hard to, you know, you have Chris Jericho on this card. You've got Raven in there. You've got Dean Malenko, Kurt Hennig, Scott Hall, all of these people on this card. And you go, oh, I would have liked to have seen these and this and that.
Yeah.
But then you remember, oh, wait, Chris Jericho was, you know, he was basically a jobber at the time. And
he was a little bit ahead. By 98, he actually, I mean, he'd gotten a decent push. I mean, he was never going to get past a certain level in WCW. That kind of became very, very apparent around this time. Mm-hmm. But he was over, and he was, you know, he was hated. I mean, he was really doing well and Well, and you could have done a Bret Hart and Chris Jericho feud around this time. You would have had Hart be the good guy, but you could have had those two and had a good feud, and it could have worked. You could have done Raven and Roddy Piper. That's one I always think would have been a great one. Or Eddie Guerrero and Randy Savage at some point. You could have done feuds with those guys, and it would have worked, but it would have required a mentality of, okay, we're going to bring these future stars and have them work with our established guys and give them, you know, the rub. Even if the young guys didn't win all those feuds, as long as they looked competitive and looked like they belonged in the same ring, it would have been fine. And it would have been a thing that someone with some – I mean, it would have been a thing that was fairly obvious at the time to anyone who had some sort of observation – who had some sort of knowledge and understanding of wrestling. Now, not to – you know, and maybe it was obvious to Eric Bischoff at the time even, you know, but he couldn't do anything about it because of politics or managing egos or whatever. But
do you know at the time – I know – it was around this point that Kevin Nash started booking. Do you know if it was before or after this match?
I think it was after this match. I think it was November-ish that was kind of when that happened. That was when, at least when I first heard it was happening. Now, it may have kind of happened beforehand. And Nash has always sort of publicly said that, well, I wasn't necessarily really booking. It was, you know, I still had to run everything through the committee. And, you know, it was like, yeah, I kind of had some responsibility, but he's always kind of, now whether it's just, you know, whether that's accurate or whether it's just, you know, to not put himself on the hook for some of the things that, you know, he did that were not good ideas, you know, who knows, but it was definitely certainly close to this time.
Yeah. This was just before Kevin Nash then started booking, and he was still, you know, kind of putting, he was getting over at the time. And I would say decently over as a babyface as part of the NWO, Red and Black.
He was really, no question, he was very over, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, he was, and one thing he did after, you know, a little bit after this, he really did a good job of getting himself over. That was really something he did very well.
I would say he was the master of getting Kevin Nash over.
Yeah, he was excellent. There's no question about it. So next, back to the match, we have Lex Luger in, who takes it to Stevie Ray for a bit. Then he goes after Brett, even though Brett helped him on Thunder. So not really convinced yet of Brett's worthiness. Stomps down Piper. Tony has a good mentions here that no one has really used the cage at all yet, which I don't recall anyone throwing anyone else into the cage at all during this match. Like, the cage pretty much is a decoration in this match.
Yeah, these aren't the gory, bloody war games of years past. These are, I don't know if they wanted to go family friendly with things. I remember at the time always feeling like WCW was the more kid and family friendly product. So
yeah,
maybe they didn't want a ton of blood.
But that was probably part of it. I mean, they had blood occasionally, but it was definitely rarer than WCW or WWE's was, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I also, it's possible. I mean, we see the cage kind of get a little bit roughed up later in the match with Warrior, and maybe none of the guys in the ring knew what part of the cage Warrior had rigged to break.
That's
so they just wanted to make sure that they weren't going to break through the cage early.
Okay, that's an interesting idea. I can see that. Honestly, like, I will say that I think this match, had it not been called War Games, had they just called it something else, like, you know, Rage in a Cage or whatever, like if they had just said it would, well, it's like War Games, but instead it's every man for himself. Like if they had just said that. Like, I don't think this match would have been, like, I don't think people would have praised it, but I don't think it would have had, like, the awful reputation that it got.
Yeah.
I think the fact that it was, like, trying to live up to the reputation of War Games, and really, honestly, there really have only been three or four, like, really fantastic War Games. Like, a lot of the other ones are just sort of, like, middle, at least of the ones that are readily available to see. I can't speak to the, you know, the War Games where they had the tours at house shows in 88 or whatever. You know, those obviously I've not seen, but the ones that, you know, are on video and are readily available to see, there aren't that many that are like really like mind blowing and fantastic. There's a lot of ones that are like perfectly fine and fun, but they're not like superior matches by any stretch. Like these, this match is not significantly worse than several of those matches.
Yeah, it's not, and it's this match.
It's ridiculous. But nothing about it, like as far as how the action goes, as far as how it's presented, is particularly anything like epically awful. Like you could put this on like an Impact like any week, and it would just be normally part of the show. Like it would, like no one would bat an eye to the ridiculousness and silliness of that in today's professional wrestling, particularly, you know, TNA.
Yeah, and I think if you were to take this match, and we'll get to it soon, but and cut out the Warrior Hogan portion of the match, I don't think it gets near as bad of reviews as it's gotten throughout the years.
Right, right. And I don't think this even makes like the top 10 of absurd chapters in the Warrior Hogan feud either.
No.
Yeah.
Those were written in the next month between Fall Brawl and Halloween Havoc.
Yes. Yeah, agreed. Agreed. So Piper gets a sleeper on Luger, but Luger sort of sets him on the apron. This is kind of where a lot of the action is kind of hard to follow, because we've got, you know, six guys in and several things going on. Eventually, Piper gets the sleeper on Stevie Ray. Then Kevin Nash comes in. He gets some pyro, which I didn't notice anybody else before that get pyro. I guess in maybe Paige in the intro did, but goes after Piper, gets some knee lifts in the corner, teases the powerbomb on Stevie, but it gets broken up. Then we have Hulk Hogan sneaking in early. He immediately goes after Piper and Nash with the slapjack, as it becomes apparent. He and Stevie Ray hug. Then we have Hogan breaking up the torture rack that Luger has on Bret Hart and the scorpion that Sting has on Paige with the slapjack in his hand. So basically, everyone is knocked out except for Hogan and Stevie Ray. And then we have Hogan and Stevie Ray basically like mugging to each other and to the crowd. And I want to talk about the comedic possibilities between Hulk Hogan and Stevie Ray, because I feel they are ample, because this minute and a half of this demonstrates what incredible connection these two characters seem to have at this point in time.
Yeah, I definitely think there could be some funny stuff. We're coming off of Road Wild 98, a month or two before, and that, of course, was when Jay Leno participated in a WCW match, and Hulk Hogan at that point tried his hand at talk show hosting.
Sure.
And I definitely could see, you know, Stevie Ray is a great sidekick, an announcer, a band leader, something like that to, you know, deliver some punchlines and to play off of Hogan a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, Stevie is milking everything Hogan is doing for all it's worth. He is the perfect lackey. There's no question about that. Like, I feel like 1998 should have been all about Hogan as like a fading rock star, and his entourage gets less and less cool. Which is kind of what happened.
Yeah, but they never highlighted it.
Right, yeah. And Stevie's kind of like the best he can do, but Stevie's like really enthusiastic. Like, this is like as high as Stevie's ever going to get in his life. And I feel like it needed to be all about like backstage sketches of like Stevie just being really excited about being with Hulk Hogan. And Hulk Hogan kind of realizing like a little bit like, wow, my star is kind of faded, you know? Kind of thing. And I really feel like that needs to be like Hogan did not need Beefcake as a disciple. Disciple really did not need to be there. Like, Stevie Ray needed to be Hogan's disciple. That needed to be kind of be what happened. That would have been so many wonderful things could have come from that, I feel like.
Yeah, I think that's the ideal way to use Stevie Ray too.
Right. It's not as part of Harlem Heat. It's as a lackey. More specifically, as Hulk Hogan's lackey.
It would have been a wonderful thing. Like that. I'm excited. I don't know if any exist, but I'm excited to see like a Hulk Hogan Stevie Ray tag team to see if like they ever teamed together and what that match would have been like, because I'm sure like I have never had any interest in seeing a Stevie Ray match in my life, but now because of what I saw here, I am intrigued.
I would approve of TNA bringing in Stevie Ray.
Oh,
just to hang out with Hulk Hogan right now.
I love that idea.
I mean, it's not out of, I don't think it's out of the question to discuss it either. They would totally go for it. And it could be one of the best moments of TNA history.
We need to start a petition. I'm against petitions in general, but I'm willing to go ahead and go along with that one.
I would sign it. I definitely would.
Okay. All right, let's get on that. Anyway, so the Stevie and Hogan, after Hogan play into the crowd a lot, they drag Kevin Nash into a corner. Hogan hits the leg drop. He and Stevie, they act like they're best buddies. They play to the crowd. They congratulate each other for, you know, this wonderful plan coming together. We have another leg drop. Hogan goes down for the cover, and then a plume of smoke enters the ring.
Yes.
And suddenly, here is a man who appears to be the Ultimate Warrior, wearing a coat. Hogan instantly attacks him from behind. We have another blast of smoke 20 seconds later or so, and Hogan is holding the coat, but there's no Warrior. Magic tricks. Everyone can get behind magic tricks.
I think they can. I think if you've watched any Undertaker feuds, especially before kind of his first Shawn Michaels feud, there were a lot of magic tricks. Yeah, and everyone loves The Undertaker, so why don't they want magic tricks for everyone? Why is John Cena not pulling a quarter out from behind my ear as we speak? That's really what I want to know.
I want to know that, too. That's something that I feel like deserves discussion.
I mean, he's sitting here in the room with me. He's just not pulling the quarter out.
Okay, wow. Well, I don't know what to say. Let's move on. So now... But by the way, I believe that the Ultimate Warrior there was being played by the Renegade, who, of course, played essentially the Ultimate Warrior in 1995, a very much warrior-like character. So that's a nice full circle thing, I think.
Yeah, you know, the Renegade in 1995 was the ultimate surprise.
Yes.
I thought Tony Schiavone had a really funny call here when the first time the plume of smoke hit, and when he went, "The ring fills up! With smoke!" I just found that really humorous. That I almost feel like Tony was going, "What is happening?" And it should also be noted that the trap door that the Warrior came through, isn't that the same trap door that the British Bulldog hurt himself on earlier in the night?
Oh, was that night? Yeah, that's right. I forgot that it happened that very night. I knew it happened during the show, but... around this time. But yeah, that's right. And he had some really, really bad... I mean, he was hospitalized for quite a while and at the time almost died. Of course, he didn't live very much longer. He made a comeback in WWE that didn't last very long and then was in bad health again. But yeah, I completely forgot about that.
Yeah, it's... I always... You know, when I watch anything from Fall Brawl... 98, which isn't often. I always try and scope out if I can see where the trap door is.
Yeah.
So.
So anyway, we have the Warrior now appears from the ramp, runs in. He takes it to Hogan and Stevie Ray. By the way, everyone else is unconscious at this point still, and they've been unconscious for a good minute and a half, 2 minutes. No one has moved at all.
Yeah, I kind of wonder if we're supposed to think it was the slapjack or the smoke.
Yeah, I, at the time, thought it was the smoke. Now I think it's the slapjack because the smoke had no effect on Hogan and Stevie Ray. And I don't True. Think Steve, I don't think WCW was so absurd as to make this to want us to believe that the smoke would only affect the men who were already down.
Good point.
Yes.
And we should also note that when Warrior appeared, they still had the clock going, but everyone had been ignoring the clock at this point.
Right.
Hogan came in early, and they somehow kept the clock going, and they said, Warrior's going to be here in a minute and a half.
Yeah.
And then the ring filled with smoke.
Right. Yes. So, anyway, Warrior gets into the ring, takes it to Hogan and Stevie Ray. Stevie is able to get a little bit of offense, which allows Hogan to escape through the door. He's helped by the Disciple who comes out. They lock the door. After a brief flurry by Stevie, Warrior makes his comeback, punching Stevie down. Warrior tries to go through the door, but he can't, obviously. Everyone starts to sort of move and recover. We're about maybe 2.5 minutes after they've all been knocked out. Warrior yells at Hogan through the cage. Then he climbs up to the top, kicks through one side of the cage, and then, of course, allowing it to open. And then I'm surprised he didn't break a hip as he, you know, comes down the cage and lands on the floor. Although I believe he hurt his bicep in this match. Or it may have been in his maybe it was a separate injury, but at some point he hurts his bicep during this time, which doesn't allow him to wrestle until the next pay-per-view. He runs after Hogan. I do really enjoy Hogan and Disciple scurrying away and not running away from the Warrior who's chasing them. I do enjoy the look on Hogan and Disciple's face. That was kind of fun. So,
yeah, that was enjoyable. The going through the cage before that, Hogan walked all the way around the two rings and Warrior just followed him in the ring, yelling at him basically right. until he decided to kick through. And then, of course, jumping down, I could swear that Warrior fell out of the cage. Watching it back, I rewound it a couple times and I went, no, I'm. The camera cuts away quick, and I think he was just getting up when the camera got to him.
Oh, wow. I didn't notice that, but it's very well possible. They managed to cover up some botches in this match, if that's the case.
Yeah, I could be very wrong on that front. It could be wishful thinking for another really great Ultimate Warrior moment, but...
Sure. I'm just going to go ahead and assume that you're correct.
Warrior does love falling.
Yes. So we have security basically break them up to prevent them from coming to blows, as I'm sure what an epic brawl that would have been between Hulk Hogan and Ultimate Warrior. The finish definitely comes too quick. If they'd had a few good minutes of this, of some like actual like War Games mayhem, it doesn't even have to be bloody, but just some throwing into the cage and some fierce fighting and some, you know, intensity and 10 cities kind of thing with the remaining 8 that were in this match. I think, again, this also could have been a little bit better remembered. Like, you could have had some distance between all the shenanigans and the finish. But basically, and also the finish doesn't come off great because you kind of have Brett and Stevie Ray both awkwardly going after Paige, and then you have Sting kind of pulling Brett away, but I'm not clear on how he sort of does it. And then DDP gets an instant diamond cutter and wins the match. There's still kind of smoke in the ring, so it's sort of unclear. Kind of a flat finish with the crowd not really being sure what's going on. And then you have DDP celebrating and having won the title shot, and that's basically it. He celebrates and that's pretty much the end of the show.
Yeah, and it was weird as the finish came. The announcers were very quick to go, oh, well, Hogan said he was going to get his title back, and this was how, but he's giving it up. They've really made a big deal to kind of cover Hogan in this, I thought, leaving and going, oh, well, Hogan is giving up a title shot here.
Yeah.
As he's running out because as he locked the door.
Which is you know, which is a good story in theory. I mean, that, you know, I get that. That makes sense going into it. I guess also the fact that Sting keeps Brett from, you know, from winning this in theory also continues the Sting Brett story. So so there's that. Of course, Brett's story was confusing anyway, but
I thought in theory though the Hogan giving up a title shot thing is great till you see that Diamond Dallas Page wins it, and it's easily the biggest win of Page's career.
Uh-huh.
But even in that, they go, Hogan's fear of the Warrior propelled Page to victory.
Ah, yes, there's that.
And I just thought, you know, that was a way to kind of, Page got this big win, but Hogan could have done it.
Right, right. Yeah, that does sort of undermine that a little bit. I mean, you can play with Hogan being the, you know, of you know, being afraid and running out of the ring when he could have had a chance to win. But, yeah, I mean, Page kind of winning it should sort of be the focus as well. And, I mean, he and Goldberg ended up having a great match at Halloween Havoc. Didn't really get much of a build-up because even though it ended up being main eventing the show, really Hogan Warrior was the center of that show. You know, leading up to it, I guess they probably realized that it was going to be an epic catastrophe and decided to not make it the final match, which was smart. But still, it, you know, the Page and DDP is well remembered and kind of regarded as one of Goldberg's best matches. But you know, going into it, it was not the biggest, certainly not the biggest thing on the show.
Yeah, and I think Page and DDP in a way is well remembered because a small percentage of viewers lost the pay-per-view feed because it went long. So they've replayed the match, the main event match from the pay-per-view the night before on Monday Nitro. So a lot of people look at it and go, oh yeah, I watched that on Nitro instead of on pay-per-view.
That's true. Yeah. That would, you know, obviously you're talking about, you know, 6 million or whatever people watching it instead of, you know, 500,000 or whatever, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think when we were talking about the ending falling flat, I think they kind of brought the crowd up in a way with Hogan and Warriors drama. And a little bit of time, like you said, would have allowed the crowd to peak again for the match ending and to pop again for the match ending.
Right.
They could have had the exact same ending, but if they had it after 5 minutes of action, it would have been a little more palatable.
Exactly. Yeah, it would have given the kind of the crowd, whether they were really excited about the Warrior thing or whether it was confusing or whatever it was, you could have gotten some distance from that. The crowd could have moved on. Okay, now we're focused back on this match, and then you could have had, you know, like you said, an ending that the crowd would have reacted to. So
yeah, they could have let the smoke clear, so to speak.
Yes. Nicely done. Nicely done. So yeah, that's basically what happened. You know, kind of the big thing, obviously, continuing the Hogan and Warrior feud, which did not really get any better, which led to a pretty disastrous match between Hogan and Warrior at Halloween Havoc, led to Warrior basically leaving right after that. I don't really know if they had any more plans for Warrior, but he certainly, you know, he had worn out his welcome pretty quickly with the fans and with pretty much everyone, I guess. And in wrestling, since Warrior, other than one appearance in Europe a few years ago, basically never wrestled again.
But you can follow Warrior on Twitter.
You can. I don't recommend doing it, but you can.
Hey, he got into a Twitter fight with Kevin Nash that was mighty interesting.
Hey, and Warrior and Nash, you know, maybe they're just trying to settle the score from this match.
It's true. I mean, they were on opposing teams that didn't matter.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. They were technically in the same ring together in this match for about 2 minutes.
Well, were they? Were they in the same ring or opposite rings?
I believe Nash was unconscious in the same ring as Warrior while Warrior was walking around. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or at least while Renegade was in there. That I know for sure. I'm not sure exactly where Nash was and Warrior was in. We, you know, we're really parsing things at this point.
Yeah. The feud still lives on to this day. Let's just put it that way.
It does. And what a magic. I'm really excited about that Kevin Nash Ultimate Warrior MMA match. I feel like that's going to really revolutionize the wrestling business.
I think it's going to revolutionize MMA. Dana White needs to get on that, man, because if he thinks they have good fights now,
yeah,
wait till Nash and Warrior get in there and show those punk kids how it's done.
Exactly, exactly. I cannot possibly wait. So Will, is there anything that you would like to plug for the listeners of this show?
I'll throw out a quick plug for ProWrestling.net. I do some writing on there Mondays, or after Raw on Monday, Impact on Thursdays, and after pay-per-views. I also write preview columns and have the occasional blog up as well. You can see that along with all of the other staff members' stuff at ProWrestling.net. And, of course, we have a members site that you can check out for exclusive member-only audio, where we break first-run news and also just have some fun reviewing shows and all of that kind of junk.
Okay. Cool. And of course, you're on Twitter as well.
Oh, yeah. At It's Will Time. And if you wanted to email me also, it's willtime@gmail.com.
Great. Well, Will, thank you again for being on the show. Always great to have a first time guest.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I had a lot of fun.
All right. And thanks, everyone, for listening. Of course, we will continue onward with Main Event Podcast. You can always check out WrestleSpective.com and FairToFlare.com for the latest. So thanks for listening, and we'll be back again soon.